We've been looking at the transition time between the Old and the New Testament and been using some of the historical materials, not inspired, but nevertheless very important to us, that have been produced about this time period. And we learned how in 332 BC, Alexander the Great arrived at Jerusalem, marking the transfer of that city and those people from the Persian Empire into his Macedonian Greek Empire. And from that time period on, we know that the Jewish people were protected in their faith by some of the decrees made through Alexander the Great's kingdom. They began speaking Greek as well as the Aramaic they were already speaking from their time in Babylonian exile. They also have their sacred scriptures written in the ancient Hebrew language. So for the Jewish people living in the 4th century, there were three key languages: Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek. In the aftermath of Alexander's death, we know that his kingdom broke up into four distinct areas, and two of them bracketed the Jewish people in their homeland of Judea and their capital city of Jerusalem. And the Greeks in Egypt, particularly the second Greek leader, Ptolemy II, felt that it was necessary for the Hebrew sacred writings to be translated into Greek. And so last session we talked about how the Septuagint came into existence right around 280 BC. And that became an important collection of books for the Jewish people moving forward in that time period. And the New Testament is written in Greek because Greek became the universal language back in the time of Alexander the Great and continued right through the events of the Gospel. And many of the quotations we see from the Old Testament in the New Testament, you can tell they were taken from the Septuagint, from the Greek translation of the Old Testament. And by that, we know that that was a common usage. It was in common usage amongst the church people of the first century. So that's why knowing when it came into existence is very, very important. Now, after that happened, we move into the following century, that is, into the 3rd century, into the 200s, the later 200s. And this is when we start seeing some conflicts happen in the Mediterranean basin between the rising of the Roman Republic from off of their peninsula of Italy, coming into conflict with the Carthaginians, the city of Carthage, which was a colony of Phoenicians coming out of the eastern end, but they occupied an awful lot of the western end of the Mediterranean. And we have the whole thing of Hannibal and Rome and the Punic Wars. We also have, of course, the Greek kingdoms of Alexander the Great's descendants in the military matters. And so all of these are kind of fighting amongst themselves, and that affects the Jewish people. In right around 200 BC, the king of the Macedonians, the Greeks in Syria, was a guy by the name of Antiochus III. Now, they called him Antiochus the Great because he accomplished an awful lot. And one of the things that he accomplished was that he took over the lower part of the Middle East, where Judea was located. And so let me read to you a little bit from Antiquities of the Jews. This is book number 12, and it's chapter number 3, subsection number 3. It says, "Now it happened that in the reign of Antiochus the Great, who ruled over all Asia, that the Jews, as well as the inhabitants of Celesyria," Celesyria just means the hollow of Syria, which means that area of Lebanon, just north of the Promised Land, but it could include the Promised Land itself. "So as well as the inhabitants of Celesyria suffered greatly, their land was sorely harassed, for while he," that is Antiochus the Great, "was at war with Ptolemy Philopater and with his son who was called Epiphanes, it fell out that these nations were equally sufferers, both when he was beaten and when he beat the others, as if they were very like to a ship in a storm, which is tossed by the waves on both sides. And just thus were they in their situation, in the middle between Antiochus's prosperity and its change to adversity." And so at length, so while all this stuff is going on, this back and forth between the Egyptian Greeks to the south and the Syrian Greeks to the north, the Jews are caught between them. And it's back and forth, back and forth, and back and forth. And then finally, it says, "When Antiochus had beaten Ptolemy, he seized upon Judea." So that happened right around the time of 200 BC. There's a great battle that takes place between the Macedonian Greeks in Syria and the Macedonian Greeks in Egypt. It's fought right there in the plains south of Mount Hermon, in the Promised Land itself. It's where we think of in the New Testament as Caesarea Philippi, or in the Old Testament, Dan is right near there too. It's by the headwaters of the Jordan River. There was a big battle, tens and tens of thousands of soldiers fighting, and the forces of Antiochus III won. And when he did that, the Ptolemies collapsed in their control of the region and withdrew to Egypt. And so the Jews are now under the Macedonian-Syrian control. Now, it is intended by Antiochus to deal fairly with the Jews. And we know that because of a letter that he sent that is recorded in Antiquities of the Jews, book 12, section 3. And let me read the letter to you. "King Antiochus to Ptolemy sends greetings." So this is out after he's beat Ptolemy's forces and taken over the region. And so this is his way of letting him know, letting the former ruler know, "This is what I'm going to be doing here now. Since the Jews, upon our first entrance on their country, demonstrated their friendship toward us, and when we came to their city, Jerusalem, received us in splendid manner and came to meet us with their senate," that's the Sanhedrin, by the way, "and gave abundance of provisions to our soldiers and to the elephants, and joined with us in ejecting the garrison of the Egyptians that were in the citadel." So this is talking about how the Jewish people apparently rose up, welcomed the Syrian Greeks, and helped chase the Egyptian Greeks out of town whenever Antiochus arrived. And they even fed the elephants, the war elephants that were part of the Greek battle arrangements. "So we thought fit to reward them and to retrieve the condition of their city, which has been greatly depopulated by such accidents as have befallen its inhabitants, and to bring those who have been scattered abroad back to the city." So he says, what I plan on doing is I'm now going to welcome back all the Jews to Jerusalem and Judea that have been scattered by all the fights that have happened recently between us. And in the first place, we've determined on account of their piety toward God, so because of their religion that's centered here at Jerusalem, to bestow on them as a pension for their sacrifices of animals that are fit for sacrifice, for wine and oil and frankincense, the value of 20,000 pieces of silver. So he says, because they're so religious and committed to the worship of their God, I'm going to give them a regular amount of money, 20,000 days' wages, apparently each year, as well as all sorts of food items that can be used in temple worship. These payments, I would have fully paid them as I've sent orders to you. I would also have the work about the temple finished and the cloisters. And if there be anything else that ought to be rebuilt, and for the materials of wood, let it be brought them out of Judea itself, out of the other countries, and out of Libanus, that's Lebanon, tax-free, and the same I would have observed as those that have other materials which be necessary in order to render the temple more glorious. And by the way, I think I accidentally said this is to Ptolemy, the king of Egypt. It's to another Ptolemy. I'm sorry about that. But anyway, this Ptolemy is to be aware that King Antiochus wants the temple brought back up fully to its glory and to be supported out of royal funds in the worship that's going on there. Continuing, let all the nation live according to the laws of their own country. Let the Senate, that's the Sanhedrin, and the priests and the scribes of the temple and the sacred singers be discharged from poll money and crown tax and other taxes also. So any members of the Sanhedrin, any priests, Levites, scribes in the temple, singers in the temple, they are all tax immune, which is something that we've seen in the ancient histories, is that even if it weren't your religion, when you were in control of a country, you did not tax the religious peoples, the ones that were carrying out the worship. The reason is because most of these people were polytheists. They believed in the worship of many gods. So when they came into contact with another religion, they just simply felt, I will treat that religion with respect and ask the people there to speak to their God on my behalf as their king. And so the Jewish people did that. And this goes back into ancient history, as we can see here, that the Jewish people at Jerusalem were constantly offering sacrifices on behalf of whatever emperor was in control of their country. And that continued all the way up to the time of Emperor Nero. And when some of the Jewish hotheads at the Jerusalem temple decided they didn't want to do that anymore, it wasn't very long after that that the war that the temple was destroyed during started. So that's right around 70 AD. So we're looking at stuff happening right around 200 BC. He continues, it says, that the city may be the sooner recover its inhabitants, I grant a discharge from taxes for 3 years to its present inhabitants and to such as shall come to it until the month Hyperberutus. So he wants to repopulate the city of Jerusalem so badly that he tells the people living at Jerusalem, you get 3 years of no taxes. Now we see this happen in modern times. I live in Mishawaka, and I know that there have been several tax incentives offered to businesses that would locate on Grape Road or on Main Street in the business area, that they'd get so much of a tax abatement for the first few years of their existence in that location just to get them to move there. And so it's a business practice, and you see that happening here. We also discharge them from the future for a third part of their taxes, that the losses they have sustained may be repaired. So basically, because some of them are having to rebuild things, we're going to, whatever taxes happen after the abatement, they're going to be reduced for, 33%. This is going to be happening. All those citizens that have been carried away and are become slaves, we grant them and their children their freedom and give order that their substance be returned to them or restored to them. So the fight back and forth between the Macedonian Greeks in Syria, the Macedonian Greeks in Egypt, Jewish people ended up being captured, turned into slaves. Well, Antiochus the Great says, well, the guys that I captured that are Jewish, I'm freeing them. And they all get to go home and they get to get their stuff back. Now, there's a little bit more that I want to read. This was the contents of this epistle. He also published a decree through all his kingdom in honor of the temple, which contained what follows. Here's the quote. It shall be lawful for no foreigner to come within the limits of the temple round about, which thing is forbidden also to the Jews, unless to those who, according to their own custom, have purified themselves. So the Greek-Syrian king in charge of Judea now, Antiochus III, upholds the ban on non-Jews coming in close proximity of the temple. He also upholds the ban on Jewish people not properly cleansed coming anywhere near the shrine building. Continues, nor let any flesh of horses or of mules or of asses be brought into the city, whether they be wild or tame, nor those of leopards or foxes or hares, and in general, that any animal which is forbidden by the Jews to eat. So he upholds the kosher law rules. There's going to be non-Jewish people living in Judea. We know that. There will be Greeks living there, because the region has come under Greek control back in the time of Alexander the Great. But because of this Greek respect for the Jewish faith in the best of times, Jewish kosher laws will be protected by Greek royal law. That's important to understand. Let them only be permitted to use the sacrifices derived from their forefathers, with which they have been obliged to make acceptable atonements to God. And he that transgresses any of these orders, let him pay to the priests 3,000 drachmae of silver. So to violate this protective order is going to end up with you having to pay to the Jewish temple through the priests 3,000 days' wages. That's a big, hefty fine. Well over $100,000 worth. This is the way that Antiochus the Third was treating the Jewish religion after he took control of the area. Now, what happens to him after this? Well, he is a man that wants to control more than what he already has. That's not surprising in emperors, is it? So he pushes toward the west into what we call Turkey today. And he starts taking over territory in that region. But the problem for him, as he's doing this in the 190s and the beginning of the 180s, is that he is actually coming into conflict with allies of the Roman Republic, people that Rome has treaties with. And so Antiochus III ends up bumping heads with the expanding Roman Republic. And in 188, he is forced, because he's lost several wars or several battles against the Romans, he is forced to sign what we know today as the Treaty of Apamea. That's in 188. Excuse me. in a nutshell, you can go and look it up for yourself to get all the details, but in a nutshell, Antiochus III was forced to pull back onto the east side of the Taurus Mountains. So completely withdraw from Asia Minor. He also has to pull back his navy to the eastern end, the extreme eastern end of the Mediterranean. He's not allowed to take them past a certain river mouth on the south coast of Turkey. Basically, he's pinned on the east side of Cyprus along the coast of his already existing country. He has to pay a huge reparation debt every year to the kings that he'd beaten in Asia Minor. And so he's got a lot of money that he has to come up with. When I say money, I'm talking about a lot of silver and gold every single year to pay to the Romans, who will then pay that back to the people of Asia Minor. And he also has to scale back his army and his navy. He's not allowed to have more than a certain number of soldiers, a certain number of war vessels, and a certain number of war elephants. And so that is the situation that he finds himself in when he dies in 187 BC. And his son, Antiochus, the next son that takes over from him is named by historians as Seleucus the Fourth. And Seleucus the Fourth continues in his relationship with the Jewish people until he dies in 175 BC. And when he dies, his son, Demetrius, is what we would call a political hostage in Rome. One of the things that the Treaty of Rome required was that so many members of the royal family had to go to Rome from Antioch and stay there. They probably were educated there and probably lived quite comfortably, but they were kept there just in case the treaty was broken. There was always the potential that they could be executed for their king breaking the treaty. So because the next king, the next legitimate king of the Macedonian Syrian Empire was a 10-year-old boy living in Rome, his uncle, the brother of the late king, decided that it would be better if he took over. Now, he was a usurper to the throne, and that's exactly the way that he is described in the prophecies in the book of Daniel. We know him as his throne name, Antiochus the Fourth, and he is a really bad guy, and we'll be focusing an awful lot on him in tomorrow's session. So Seleucus the Fourth is assassinated in 175 BC by his finance minister. His brother, Antiochus the Fourth, kills that assassin and then assumes control in Syria as the new king. And this is where we can start bringing in the writings of the Maccabees. That's all reported in 1 Maccabees 1:10. The following year, we have the Jewish high priests, and I use that plural advisedly, are trying their best to get in good with the new king. Now, the high priests have been fighting and bickering among themselves for a while now because you've got two different mindsets going on. You've got one group that wants to maintain the integrity of the unique Jewish faith and the unique Jewish culture. Everything kosher, everything separated from the non-Jews of the world, keeping things holy. But you've got another group that wants to kind of move on, that wants to progress into the modern era. That's the mindset they've got. And they want things to be much more Greek-like. They don't want to be different from the other peoples in the Greek kingdom that they're part of. They even want to do away with the circumcision ceremonies, things of that nature. There's even been the development of a reversal operation that allows those that have already been circumcised to be able to look like they haven't been. Now, the reason for this is because Greek culture rotates an awful lot around the gymnasium. Gymnasium in Greek is pronounced gymnasium. And gymnos in Greek means naked, because the exercises that went on in the gymnasium, the naked place, took place with no clothes on. And so Jewish people looked weird. Jewish men looked different in that sort of community setting. And so a lot of the more progressive Jews are wanting to not be circumcised. They want to participate in the gymnasium ceremonies and activities with non-Jewish people. And so they're wanting to change their society. And at least some of the religious Jews, or I should say some of the priests and Levites, want to go along with that. And so when we come back tomorrow, we're going to talk about how the Jewish high priesthood gets taken over by one of those progressives, and how this is the beginning of a great rebellion within the Jewish faith itself.